ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 6th of January. I'm David Lipson in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. I am the president. The defiant words of deposed Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro as he appeared in a New York court pleading not guilty to criminal charges brought by the United States. Those charges are the Trump administration's justification for a brazen military operation that captured Maduro and his wife Celia Flores in Caracas. As the world watches on in shock, the South American nation has now formally sworn in an interim leader. Our correspondent Ben Knight is in Washington. Ben, take us through what happened in court.
Yeah, so this was very preliminary. This is essentially the beginning of the process. This is the first court appearance of the Maduros, and they did appear in court. They were led in wearing prison clothes. Nicolas Maduro was shackled at the ankles, but not at the hands. The judge in this instance was pretty quick to shut down what looked like an intention of Nicolas Maduro to do a bit of speechifying, if you like, to make a statement. He said, well, these are matters we'll get to later on. Essentially, he was saying, can we confirm who you are and how do you plead? Nicolas Maduro pleaded not guilty. He said, I'm innocent, and insisted that he was the still currently the president of Venezuela. His wife, Celia Flores, also pleaded not guilty. Now, their lawyers did have a couple of things to say. And as I say, these are currently court-appointed lawyers. Now, that's not to say that they will be representing Nicolas Maduro or his wife whenever this actually comes to trial. But they are reasonably high-profile lawyers nonetheless. One of them is Barry Pollack, who's representing Nicolas Maduro. It's a name some people might recognise. He's represented Julian Assange. It may be that he sticks with his case, but one of the things that he had to say would that there would be likely motions made concerning Nicolas Maduro's role as the head of a sovereign state, saying that he is entitled to the privileges and the immunities of that office, also flagging that the defence would be raising issues with the legality of what he called the military abduction. Again, the judge said, look, yep, we'll get to all of those things, but for now, it's are you who we think you are? Can you confirm your identity? Pleaded not guilty, and it wrapped up pretty shortly after that.
The whole world is meanwhile still left wondering what the future is for Venezuela. Are we any closer to understanding that?
Donald Trump had some things to say about the US potentially running Venezuela for a while. We're no clearer on what that might look like. Does it mean US administrators there? I think that probably seems less likely at the moment. What you would be more likely looking at is some kind of government inside Venezuela that is prepared to work with the United States. There's no detail, there's no direction on anything on that. And the Venezuelan legislature has met for its first session for the year to set up, you know, itself for the next 5 years. The vice president has been sworn in, so that raises a question. Who is the president? If Nicolas Maduro is in New York saying that he's still the president, but you have the vice president in Venezuela being sworn in, does that then trigger, you know, an election process in Venezuela? What would that look like? Who would run it? So it's all very, very unclear at the moment.
Certainly is. Ben Knight there in Washington. The deposed Venezuelan president is facing charges of narco-terrorism and importing cocaine. And while Venezuela is not a major cocaine producer, it has become one of the most important transit countries in South America. Now a former chief of operations for the US Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, has told AM that after bringing down the trade in Venezuela, Colombia could be the next target. Here's Nicole Johnston.
Ray Donovan has seen it all. As a former special agent and the boss of the US Drug Enforcement Administration in New York, he was in charge of the manhunt for the Mexican drug kingpin El Chapo. But the DEA veteran says the raid on Nicolas Maduro was on another level, and years of cross-country intelligence gathering went into it.
We've wanted Maduro since 2020. That's when the indictment really took place. I happened to be the special agent in charge of New York, and I was lucky to be a part of that, working with a really strong group of investigators that brought that indictment in New York, in the Southern District of New York. So it really sends a message to other leaders that are engaged in not only drug trafficking or narco drug trafficking, but also terrorist activities. Because the thing with Maduro and that administration is they had ties to Iran and to Hezbollah in Caracas.
Could you explain for us what exactly Venezuela's role is in the drugs trade?
So Venezuela, and more particularly the Maduro administration, was involved with collaborating with Colombian guerrilla groups in southern Colombia that oversaw the production of hundreds upon hundreds of tons of cocaine. That cocaine that was produced and smuggled in through Venezuela and then smuggled up to the coast, the northern coast of Venezuela, where it then be shipped into places like the Dominican Republic. And then once it arrived in the Dominican Republic, it would go either to the United States or to go into Europe, or it can go into Spain, it can go into the Dutch Netherlands, it can even go into West Africa from Venezuela. So it was really part of the major transportation routes for the Colombians. Now, going back 10 years ago, they were also flying Venezuelan aircraft from that same area into places like Honduras and Guatemala, destined for Mexico, destined for the U.S. via that route as well.
So to really go after this trade, would you also have to go after Colombia?
Yes. So there's a longstanding history of DEA and U.S. law enforcement, U.S. military, U.S. intelligence working directly with Colombia to go after these groups for many, many decades. The challenge for us was DEA got kicked out of Venezuela in 2005. And so since 2005 to the present, the trade has just grown. Production of cocaine is through the roof. Even under Petro, the current president of Colombia, cocaine production is the highest it's ever been, literally. And so all the cocaine that you see in places like even Australia, it's derived from the Andean region of South America. And because the scrutiny and the ability to go after these organizations has been limited, that's opened up a lot of what we see going on throughout the world. Thousands upon thousands of tons of cocaine going into Europe. This is what really forced our hand here.
Ray, you were a major part of bringing down El Chapo in Mexico. Is Nicolas Maduro a bigger fish?
I'd say he's a bigger fish in the sense that it's beyond just purely drug trafficking. I'd say he's a bigger fish in regards to his role in Venezuela and the Western Hemisphere and the world. His collaboration with China, with Russia, with Iran, with other corrupt groups throughout the world.
That's the former Chief of Operations for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, Ray Donovan, speaking to our reporter, Nicole Johnston. So what are the implications of this U.S. action for the international rule of law? Michael Green is a former advisor to the White House National Security Council. He's now the CEO of the United States Studies Center. Michael Green, thanks for being with us. You were in the White House when decisions about regime change were being made in regards to Iraq and Afghanistan. What would you say to current occupants of the White House in regards to American involvement in Venezuela's future?
It's a good question. To be clear, I was in charge of Indo-Pacific policy, so I was tangential to the decisions on Iraq and Afghanistan, but I could see what people were assuming. I could see what they were struggling with, and of course we could all see what happened. I think the main lesson is, as challenging as these operations are and as really professional as the U.S. military is, very few militaries could do this, in some ways that's the easy part, and what comes next is the hard part. And it's not entirely clear from President Trump's previous statements, from his press conference, what his ultimate objective or plan is. Things are chaotic in Caracas, Venezuela right now. The vice president, Ms. Rodriguez, they hoped to sort of align more with the United States, but she's being quite defiant, and is a protege of President Maduro, who was captured and arrested and charged with narco crimes in New York. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And the political support for Iraq 20-some years ago was quite robust. I mean, a majority of Democrats in the Senate supported it. The American public, only 17% supported using force against Venezuela before this happened. And while the Republicans are largely behind President Trump, he has some important defectors within his own base, within the MAGA movement. So he's on less certain domestic political ground, too. So a lot of uncertainty, a lot of things the administration will really have to clarify and figure out.
More broadly, what signal does this show of brute force by a powerful country against a weak one send to the rest of the world?
Well, I make two points on that. The first is Donald Trump commands a lot of attention. People think he's a major aberration and disruptor, and he is by historical comparison. But, you know, President Obama used force in the Middle East without consulting Congress. President George Herbert Walker Bush invaded Panama 30-some years ago to remove a narco trafficker, Manuel Noriega. So it's not as unprecedented or unusual, or even, as some people say, illegal as is being charged, even though Donald Trump pushes it as everything to another level. The other point I'd make is I don't think regimes like Putin's in Moscow or Xi Jinping or North Korea, they're not Boy Scouts. They're not looking at this and saying, oh, I didn't know that was allowed, and then thinking differently about their strategy. They want to use force, and they will, and they'll get away with what they can. Where I think it hurts, and this will affect Australia, is not that it will change the behavior of regimes like North Korea or China or Russia, but rather that in their propaganda, in their narrative in places like Southeast Asia, they'll get some advantage. They'll say, look at the American imperialists. And it will make it harder to mount diplomatic pressure on Ukraine or on Taiwan. It will make it diplomatically more challenging. But I don't think it changes the behavior of these regimes, which will get away with what they can.
So are you expressing some skepticism there about what some have described as the emergence of a new version of the Monroe Doctrine of two centuries ago? Some have called it the Donroe Doctrine, where the world is kind of carved into spheres of influence with powerful countries in each running the show, if you like, through a might is right approach.
I think that personally is overstated. You can certainly see flavoring along those lines in the way Trump acts and talks. But ultimately, I think that President Trump's foreign policy is a combination of his own very personalized view towards other leaders and other countries, not systematic, not always strategic, whether they angered him or not, and with some pretty predictable and longstanding American interests. So, for example, no American government was satisfied with Maduro's behavior. Removing him removes a major source of narco trafficking, of support for Cuba and other regimes that threaten U.S. interests. So I think there is, within this military action against Venezuela, some fairly longstanding and bipartisan views of what American interests require in the region. But it has this flavoring of Donald Trump's sort of personalized, you know, don't mess with me demonstration of power. And that's why it's a bit unpredictable and could frankly go badly for the president if he does not figure out some of these questions about who actually governs Venezuela. There's a lot of sort of bravado right now, and it's not clear the planning has gone into it.
That was Michael Green, former advisor to the White House National Security Council and now CEO of the United States Studies Center. To Iran now, where the government there says it is ready to repel any attacks or attempts to incite regime change in the country from the United States or Israel. Protests against the government are continuing around Iran, with human rights groups saying security forces are killing and wounding increasing numbers of demonstrators. The United States president has promised to intervene in Iran if the killings continue, while Israel says it is watching and welcoming the unrest. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Video from the city of Malekshahi shows protesters yelling on the street. Then there's gunfire and several people fall to the ground. The Kurdistan Human Rights Network says three people were killed in the city on Saturday. At least 16 people have been killed across Iran since the protests began a week ago, according to rights groups and Iranian news outlets. The Iranian government has accused Israel and the United States of inciting the protests and trying to topple the clerical regime. Esmail Baghaei is the spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry.
Actions or statements raised by figures such as the Prime Minister of the Zionist regime or some radical American officials regarding Iran's internal affairs amount under international norms to nothing more than incitement to violence, incitement to terrorism, and incitement to killing.
US President Donald Trump has threatened to hit Iran very hard if its security forces kill protesters, as they've done in previous episodes of unrest. But Esmail Baghaei says the Iranian military is ready.
With all our strength and with every ounce of our being, we are monitoring the actions of the opposing parties. And in defence of Iran's integrity, our armed forces will show no negligence or hesitation.
The demonstrations began when traders shut their shops in protest at the sharp fall in the Iranian currency and high inflation. Iran's government has announced it will provide support payments to help people buy food, and it's also replaced the governor of the central bank. But in addition to economic change, many Iranians are demanding an end to Iran's theocratic dictatorship, airing long-standing grievances about repression and corruption. Iran's enemy Israel has threatened to strike again if Iran rebuilds its nuclear or ballistic missile capabilities, which were attacked by Israel and the United States in June. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country welcomes the protests and hopes they will depose the regime. The United States attack on Venezuela has sparked speculation similar action could be used in Iran, although the two countries are vastly different in both capabilities and political structure. Nevertheless, it's raised the tension and the stakes even higher.
Eric Torchek there. Almost 7 million Australians living on the fringes of capital cities are at a growing risk of fire danger, according to a new report compiled by former fire chiefs and the Climate Council. Drawing on lessons from the deadly Californian fires, which blazed through large metropolitan areas almost a year ago, the report stresses that greenhouse gases are further fueling the risk. Kimberly Price reports.
Let's get out of here. Whatever I lose, and there's nothing I can do about it.
It was a deadly series of infernos that saw 14 fires burn across Los Angeles metropolitan area down to San Diego, destroying nearly 16,000 homes and businesses. Almost 12 months on, fire and climate change expert John Valiant says many people are still living in limbo.
It's really one of the most complicated rebuilds ever attempted in the United States.
In Los Angeles, suburban development has quickly crept into what was once bushland, and it's a similar story closer to home.
These cities that we want to protect are growing and growing into the wildlife-urban interface, into the bushland that actually exposes more people to fire risks.
Could what happened in LA happen in somewhere like Australia?
Kim, I take no pleasure in saying this, but absolutely, yes.
That's a fear Melbourne resident Nellie Stevenson shares. At her home in Caroline Springs on Melbourne's Western Fringe, she says there's plenty of bushland around and not much fire preparedness knowledge.
If you look at it on the map, you can just see houses, 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 bang, and then it's just grassland and farms for about 20 kilometres in every direction. People in this area, I don't think, understand the risk of grass fires, and particularly when it comes to smoke inhalation.
The population on the outskirts of Australian cities has exploded in the past 25 years. A report by the Climate Council out today warns that as development edges into bushland, the risk of fire burning through urban areas, much like what happened in California last year, could happen. It predicts nearly 7 million Australians who live on the edges of capital cities could be at risk of urban fires, and that risk is supercharged by climate change.
Climate pollution has now created an unstable climate. It is unstable, full stop.
Peter Dunn was the commissioner of the inaugural Emergency Services Authority, launched after the 2003 Canberra fire disaster, which saw bushfires spread to the suburbs and destroy more than 500 homes. He contributed to the report.
As our cities expand, as LA has expanded, people that are living in suburbia who haven't thought about bushfires before now need to become aware.
This fire season has so far destroyed dozens of homes and claimed the life of a firefighter in Western Australia.
Kimberly Price there, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.